You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Parliament grounds have been cleared and the grass will regrow, but the disinformation networks behind the protests remain. This is how disinformation researcher Byron Clark described the aftermath of March's Parliament occupation. In a new journal article, Clark reflects on the media's role in the occupation, from far-right networks such as Counterspin to mainstream platforms such as Newsroom and Newstalk ZB, and urges journalists not to ignore disinformation networks, but to investigate them and analyse the role they are playing in our contemporary post-truth world. I spoke to Byron Clark this morning and started by asking him whether he was surprised when the group converged upon Parliament grounds.
It wasn't really that surprising. I'd hoped that it wouldn't turn violent, but listening to the rhetoric of some of the people who had been organising and promoting the protest, it was always a possibility.
So Counterspin is the far-right conspiracy media network that was integral in spreading information to do with the protest. How did they come to be such a prominent platform in the far-right conspiracy scene, and who's bankrolling them?
It's hard to say exactly who's bankrolling them. It's probably most likely that they're just funded by their supporters, by people who watch the show, making small donations. But there are some questions that I think I'd like to see answers to. There's definitely a link there between Counterspin Media and an organisation called Himalaya New Zealand, who are affiliated with a political lobby group called the New Federal State of China, which was started by a distant Chinese billionaire, Guo Wengui, and former Trump advisor Steve Bannon. I don't know if Himalaya New Zealand is providing any funding for Counterspin, but they did approach the hosts about starting a show and provide a studio space. So there's some questions to be asked there. The original company that Counterspin broadcast on, GTV, which was owned by Guo and Bannon, has now filed for bankruptcy, and they're uploading their videos to band.video, which is part of the network of websites owned by Alex Jones's InfoWars. So there's questions there as well about what exactly their relationship with InfoWars is.
A portion of the protesters at Parliament was simply anti-vaccine mandate. But how easy is it to fall down the far right-wing rabbit hole when you watch Counterspin or frequent these Telegram channels and see and hear from like-minded people?
I think, it wouldn't be right to categorise everyone at the protest as being on the far right. Many people who were there would dispute that, and I don't think it's fair to say that a lot of them don't necessarily hold far right views. But the far right has been actively trying to use the anti-vaccine, anti-mandate movement to recruit people and to sow distrust of the government and sow distrust of international organisations like the World Health Organization, like the United Nations, and gain more of an audience for their ideas. So people are starting to join Telegram groups or watch a show like Counterspin, maybe starting because they are sceptical about vaccines or they have potentially even some legitimate concerns about, you know, mandates or lockdowns or whatever, and they're then getting exposed to, you know, a much bigger package of political ideas. Many of those, are far right in nature, you know, conspiracy theories about the New World Order or even some classic anti-Semitic conspiracy theories like things about the Protocols of the Elders of Zion you see talked about in these Telegram groups. So people are coming in through sort of anti-vaccine conspiracy theories and then getting involved and getting caught up in a whole lot more.
So it's been about 5 months since the fiery end to the Parliament occupation. What trajectory has the far-right media sphere in New Zealand been on since then? Did it knock them or invigorate them?
I think immediately afterwards, they felt invigorated. But at the same time, they've struggled to keep that momentum going. But they've certainly tried. Right after the protests, Counterspin purchased a bus and did a nationwide tour, hosting meetings in cities and towns around the country, some of which were actually quite well attended. And what we're seeing now is a lot of people who were involved in the protest, particularly the anti-vaccine, anti-mandate group Voices for Freedom, now encouraging people to run for office in the upcoming local elections. So all the groups and the individuals who were behind organising the protest, they're still active now. They're still producing media. They're still organising smaller events, smaller protests. We've seen the Freedom and Rights Coalition, which is really a front group for the Destiny Church, still doing regular protests. And I expect as we go into election year next year, we're going to see a lot more activity from these groups.
And in your article, you've given a few examples, but what mistakes did mainstream media make when covering the occupation?
I would say that part of the problem was the mainstream media hadn't been paying a huge amount of attention to the far right. So there was lots of coverage, of course, of the Christchurch shooting when that happened. But there was a prevalent idea that this was an anomaly and this was a lone wolf attack and this was somebody who wasn't even from New Zealand. Whereas at the same time, there were far right groups active on social media, gaining sizable audiences. And very few journalists were looking at that space, and which is why I think when the protest happened, media started approaching people like myself, who not even a full-time journalist. I work a day job and then I do a little bit extra outside of that. That's changed a bit now, of course. But when the protests happened, it really made it obvious that, you know, there is a sizable far-right movement and an overlapping sort of conspiracist movement, an wider anti-government movement. And I think a lot of journalists in this country were not prepared to do that really deep coverage because this all seemed like something new, when really it was something that had been brewing under the surface for years by that point.
So when covering far-right things like this, is it essentially a balancing act between letting New Zealanders know about this subset of people and also not giving them a platform to continue to disseminate their dangerous views?
Yeah, definitely. So I think one mistake we saw that I do talk about in that article was the coverage given by Melanie Reid of Newsroom to Voices for Freedom. Voices for Freedom are usually quite dismissive or at least sceptical of the mainstream media, but they were so happy with the way they were portrayed that they sent the interview out to their mailing list, and it was briefly one of the most viewed pages on the Newsroom website. So mainstream media became complicit in promoting this disinformation group. And I think you want to perhaps give a balance, and maybe some of these people will need to be spoken to, but that should be balanced with talking to somebody like a representative of the Disinformation Project who's been studying these groups. Ideally, I think we shouldn't be giving much of a platform at all to some of the groups who are spreading disinformation or hate. I think we should just be talking to, you know, people like the Disinformation Project or other academics who are studying these phenomena. But if you have to have balance, you definitely shouldn't just be talking to a group like Voices for Freedom. You should also talk to somebody who studies disinformation or somebody who studies conspiracy theories, and include that in your article or your video as well.
That was disinformation expert Byron Clark chatting to me about the media's role in the Parliament occupation earlier this year. If you want to read Byron's article, I'll link it alongside the BCast after the show.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/BCasts.